From WXXI News, I'm Evan Dawson. This is Connections. Maybe we've been thinking about space all wrong. The science writer Shannon Sterone had a wonderful piece on the cover of Esquire magazine recently, essentially saying, yeah, we're obsessed with aliens, we're obsessed with going to space, just watch the space billionaires this summer. But we're sort of doing it wrong. When we think about aliens, we ascribe these human characteristics. But would we even recognize or know how to communicate with aliens if we found them or if they found us? And why are we obsessed with just breaking out of the Earth's atmosphere and spending a lot of money to go boldly where many men and women have gone before? Is there a different way to think about this? Is there a different way to think about ourselves? The science writer Shannon Sterone joins us on Connections.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. A Democratic-led congressional panel is citing new documents and alleging that former President Donald Trump misrepresented the financial health of his Washington, D.C. hotel while in office. NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports a House committee says the hotel located near the White House received nearly $4 million in payments from foreign governments during his presidency.
The House Oversight and Reform Committee obtained documents from the General Services Administration, which discovered that although Trump reported his D.C. hotel brought in $150 million while he was president, the hotel actually incurred upwards of $70 million in losses. It also found that Trump concealed hundreds of millions of dollars of debt from the GSA when bidding on the lease for the hotel building. The committee also found that Trump received undisclosed preferential treatment from a foreign bank on $170 million loan to his hotel that Trump personally guaranteed. The House Oversight Committee is calling for further investigation in light of these findings. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News.
President Biden's restoring the original boundaries of two large national monuments in Utah. His predecessor had dramatically cut the size of the Bear's Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante monuments. Here's NPR's Kirk Sigler.
Earlier this year, the nation's first Indigenous Interior Secretary, Deb Haaland, traveled to Utah to tour the disputed land. Bear's Ears is on land considered sacred to many Native Americans. The area is rich in artifacts and full of ancient camping and burial grounds. As President Donald Trump reduced its boundaries by 85%, and in the nearby famous Red Rock Canyon country, he also whittled down protections for the Grand Staircase, with an eye toward expanding coal mining there. Utah's Republican governor is calling the Biden reversal disappointing, saying it's the role of Congress to pass legislation to protect lands like these. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.
Biden's issuing the first ever presidential proclamation of Indigenous Peoples Day, which many across the U.S. now reference, instead of the federal holiday celebrating Christopher Columbus. He writes of the Indigenous people's resilience against generations of attempts to eradicate Native cultures. Biden also challenges a nation facing deep racial and cultural divisions to recognize that a measure of this country's greatness is to face shameful episodes of our past honestly. Meanwhile, the president's facing backlash for using a public health policy to enable mass expulsions of migrants. Texas Public Radio's Sophia Sanchez reports on immigrant advocates' latest protests.
The groups told the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights that the Biden administration's use of Title 42 is illegal and inhumane. It sends migrants back to dangerous conditions in their home countries without the right to seek asylum. A federal judge has ruled the practice unconstitutional, but expulsion flights continue as the Biden administration defends it in court.
That's Sophia Sanchez reporting. You're listening to NPR News. 136 countries now have a deal that sets the global minimum tax rate at 15%. The landmark accord represents more than 90% of global GDP. It goes into effect 2023. It aims to reallocate more than $125 billion of profits from around 100 of the world's largest and most profitable companies to countries worldwide and ensures that these firms pay a fair share of tax wherever they operate and generate profits. It's a big win for Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, who in April proposed the idea of a global minimum tax rate for corporations. The move was designed to reverse a decades-long pattern in which countries undercut one another by steadily decreasing their corporate tax rates. China is imposing a more than $500 million fine on a major tech company that it says acts like a monopoly. NPR's Emily Fang reports it's the second hefty fine regulators have issued this year, as they increase the Chinese government's control over the country's powerful tech sector.
If you live in China, you can use the company Meituan to order groceries to your house, rent restaurants, buy movie tickets, and even rent a shared bike. However, Meituan also discouraged competition by preventing merchants from advertising or selling services on other platforms, a practice regulators are now cracking down on. The $530 million fine is about 3% of Meituan's total revenues last year. It's also significantly less than the record $2.8 billion fine market regulators imposed earlier this year on Alibaba, an e-commerce company run by billionaire Jack Ma. Emily Fang, NPR News, Beijing.
I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include C3 AI. C3 AI software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable problems. C3 AI. This is enterprise AI.
From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2004 when Commander David Fravor of the U.S. Navy witnessed something that he found extraordinary. In the pages of Esquire, science writer Shannon Sterone picks up the story. Quote, Fravor was behind the controls of a fighter jet over the Pacific Ocean when he spotted something weird. It hovered over the water, churning it so forcefully that it appeared to be boiling. Moments later, the object accelerated away from him at a shocking speed. In 2015, another Navy pilot spied a fast-moving object at low altitude over the Atlantic. What the blank is that thing, he radioed. I'm editing for our radio listeners. What the blank is that thing, he wondered, a sentiment that basically everyone who heard about the two incidents shared. We've been wondering pretty much exactly that for as long as humans have walked the Earth, searching for meaning and connection in the skies above us. But it's lately reached a fever pitch and almost wishful fervor. You might even say we've become obsessed, end quote. Sterone's cover story in Esquire is titled, You're Asking the Wrong Questions About Aliens. She writes that often when we think about aliens, we conjure up images that seem more like human beings in funny suits. We ascribe our characteristics to others. She writes, quote, Maybe our renewed itch for neighbors comes at a time when we are longing to be saved, not just from the fate of human life, but from ourselves. As I wrote this essay, two billionaires found Earth so unsatisfactory that they launched themselves off the planet, and forest fires burned 400,000 acres of wilderness in Oregon, producing a haze that traveled all the way to New York City, blurring out the sun, end quote. Sterone has been critical of the space race by the billionaire class, which culminated in Bezos and Branson and Musk competing to touch the stars this past summer. This hour, a conversation about how we see the stars and how we see ourselves. Shannon Sterone is a writer whose work has appeared in Esquire, in the New York Times, and Wired, and the Atlantic, and the Washington Post, among others. Shannon, welcome back to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Later this hour, we're going to hear from astrophysicist Brian Koberlein, who feels like there might be some benefit to a billionaire class going to space, but also some risk, and he's going to talk about that. He'll also discuss briefly the obsession we've had with UFOs, or I guess they don't want us to say UFOs anymore, Shannon. They want us to change the terminology. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, they're trying to change the nomenclature so that we're not using the same term, which has all of these connections to science fiction and, you know, these sort of fake beings that we associate with aliens. So they're trying to have us use different language, which I think is probably smart.
Sure. And listeners, this is not about sort of a judgment on any individual video or claim or investigated allegation, because I suspect we'll get some feedback on that. We always do. And listeners, you want to share your thoughts about how we see ourselves and how we see ourselves in the cosmos? 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. And there's a lot of angles to hit this hour. We're going to get to space billionaires coming up in just a little bit. But let's start with your story that ended up in the pages of Esquire, in which you kind of examine the way we are obsessing these days about aliens, but the questions that we're asking might necessarily not necessarily be the right ones. Tell me about sort of the overall thesis there, and then we're going to get specific, Shannon.
Yeah, I think that our obsession and fascination with aliens and intelligent life elsewhere in the universe is one that's, you know, justified. It's incredibly interesting to think about, are we alone in the cosmos? And I think that, you know, as many people who are involved in the field understand that with those questions just breeds more questions. And part of that comes from, you know, what do we think of as life? Have we defined what life is? And if we have, does that mean it can be artificial life? If there's a robot that sends a signal that we detect, is that life? You know, we're sort of limited by our own existence and what we understand of on our own planet. So part of essentially the thesis of that essay was we're looking into the stars and listening and hoping we'll, you know, catch a signal from another being that looks and sounds like us and has the same technological abilities, right? But that's incredibly limiting because we're just one species that just has one, you know, main, you know, we've utilized the radio magnetic spectrum, but there's so much more. And so by asking those questions and looking for something so specific, we are limiting our own understanding of what we could be finding. And in doing so, I think that points the question back at us, which is, what do we consider life? What do we consider intelligence? And what are we not considering when we think about life in the universe?
Yeah, your piece was, it was also kind of a quick tour through the history of science fiction on Hollywood screens, and there's been a lot of bad movies about space, but there's some good stuff. You liked Contact. I haven't seen Arrival, I think, the 2016 film, but there was a line in your piece that was really interesting about, I think it was about Arrival, if I'm remembering correctly, in which we couldn't even really communicate with the aliens who arrive in Arrival until, I guess, until we... bring, I think, a little bit more understanding, not just describing our own characteristics then. Is that a good description of that?
Yeah, well, first of all, please see Arrival. It's a fantastic movie. It's one of my favorites. But you're right that sorry to give you any spoilers, but you'll still love it. But what happens is we do make contact with another intelligent being, and in order to understand the way that they're communicating with us, they bring in linguists who then spend all of this time deciphering their language. And I think a perfect correlation for that is that we have categorized intelligence already on this earth. I mean, whales are intelligent, dolphins are intelligent, trees are intelligent, but we don't understand their language and they don't understand ours. That does not mean they're not intelligent, but the fact that, you know, we for decades have been trying to understand whale songs and we still don't. We know that they only make certain sounds once. They don't repeat their songs, but we don't understand what they're saying. So to have an intelligent being come to visit the planet and to just, well, of course we'll be able to have a conversation with them. Not at all. That's not a given whatsoever. I think in Arrival, she's lucky that they were able to decipher the alien language, and it's a fantastic film, but we're a little bit arrogant in our confidence of, well, when we are contacted, if we are contacted, we'll be able to have a conversation with them. And the reality is it's probably going to be something like, we'll find whales and go, wow, well, I can see you exist. You see I exist. Well, we can't talk to each other.
Mm. For some reason, until your piece, I never thought about communication that way. I mean, certainly there is this idea that any contact at all would create a possible barrier of communication. But boy, you make it very stark when you say, hey, aren't whales cool? We can't understand them. And we're right here and they're right there. We have no idea what they're saying to each other. What makes you think that something that can travel billions or trillions of miles across the cosmos, we're going to be able to go, yeah, they said that they would like pudding. You know,
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. And I think that's part of the brilliance of Contact touches on that too, which is the universal language in the universe is math and physics. And so that would be our one, you know, hope of being able to understand, you know, do you know what one plus one is. And of course, if they were traveling here, absolutely they would, because they would be so far advanced beyond us that their understanding of physics and quantum mechanics and everything would be well beyond our comprehension. But it is, you know, if we did detect a signal, say we said he detected a signal tomorrow, we would probably not understand that signal whatsoever. We would just simply know there's someone else out there who is broadcasting either purposely or accidentally, and we picked it up. And wow, isn't that amazing? We're not alone. What did the signal say? What is the data? We have no clue. It's less romantic and less exciting, but it's the most likely outcome if that ever happens.
This is why you're such a good science communicator, because that's another great point that I've never thought of in those terms. The real common language of the universe is math. You put it so much more succinctly than a scientist who once told me, hey, we think at least the law of thermodynamics travels. And so, you know, there are probably scientific principles that have to be followed and adhered to, and the laws of energy feedback loops, climate change could be happening just about anywhere. Mm-hmm. The impact on environment when people or aliens or beings are harvesting energy. So, but you're right, the language of the universe is math. And maybe that will connect us, maybe not enough. I don't know. Because you also write another interesting point that I want to read a little bit from and ask you to kind of talk about. What you're saying here in this paragraph is that aliens that we could ever be in touch with are probably smart enough not to have war with themselves. So let me read from this. You write, quote, "There's another problem. Those supposed aliens might have rendered themselves extinct by the time our messages reach them. When an entire species removes itself from the evolutionary running, scientists attribute that to the Great Filter. Climate change and devastating nuclear war are examples of this phenomenon of self-destruction. If we found artificially intelligent life, it would have also had to survive the Great Filter. They would need to be programmed to not attack each other," Webb explains. "This is not something our species has mastered. To progress past the technological threshold where we can travel deeper into space or build intelligent robotic surrogates to do it in our stead, we must not just survive, but become more like the savior version of the aliens we have envisioned," end quote. Mm. I hate to say that you strike me a little bit as a pessimist that we could ever pull this off because of how self-destructive we are. Where are you on that right now?
Yeah, your judgment is correct. I am pretty pessimistic sometimes about our ability to save ourselves. I think that we are, you know, very capable. I think that our continued inaction on climate change is not a great indicator that we will survive our own great filter, but the verdict remains unknown. But it is, you know, true that any other civilization, I mean, you should think about in terms of, you mentioned the space billionaires, but our ability to just launch off of Earth, to go to Mars with a robot, we have not been able to send humans anywhere. The physical challenges of sending a spacecraft not only to other planets in a solar system, but beyond a galaxy, beyond a star system, for another being or life form to come and visit us takes such intelligence. And, you know, the fact that there's this great line, I keep coming back to Contact, but Carl Sagan was a brilliant writer, but there's this line in the movie where Jodie Foster is being judged by this panel and saying, you know, before we send you on the spacecraft, what would you like to ask the aliens? And she said, "I would first ask them, how did you survive this technological adolescence?" And that is essentially the test that we're in right now. Are we going to survive our technological adolescence, or are we going to great filter ourselves out of existence? And right now we're sort of heading in one direction, but any other life form that would contact us or have the physical ability to travel between star systems would have survived that. They would have learned, okay, no more wars. We're not going to burn fossil fuels or you know, material that ruins our atmosphere because we've got one planet and we're here. So we're sort of in this precarious place in our own lifetime of just human existence, let alone our generation, where we can decide, do we get to become one of those beings that has the potential of going and finding other people, or are we going to die out?
Mm. Well, Speaking of that, Dominic writes to say, Evan, great conversation, but you are missing something. If we ever meet aliens, it's because they discovered us, and then we would just become food.
That is a great comment, and I disagree with that, because while that's entirely possible, anything's possible, but any being, any intelligent civilization that has evolved to the point where they can travel to another star system and then find us on Earth and go, oh, look at little Earthlings or big Earthlings or however it is, are not going to then say, well, I guess we might as well eat them for a snack. That's convenient. You know, it's that the likelihood of that is pretty low, because any civilization that advanced would not need food the way we need food. They would not be, you know, that hungry for resources. I mean, if we get to the point where we can travel like that and we're that hungry that we're going to try to go eat microbes on another planet, I mean, that's a pretty bad sign. So the logic of that doesn't quite check out, just because of how advanced you have to be to be traveling in that way. But entirely possible. It's one of the reasons why a lot of scientists and physicists say we should not be sending signals out into the universe, because if we say, hey, we're here, and some other civilization is low on resources and they go, ooh, meat, cool, yeah, let's go eat them, you know, then we run the risk. But, you know, we're also burning fossil fuels and climate change. So it's sort of like, pick your poison. Do you want to be eaten by aliens at a possibility that is so incredibly low, or, you know, die from a warming climate? So
which is a much higher likelihood. Yeah, exactly.
Much higher likelihood, yeah.
Exactly. Talking to Shannon Sterone, a writer whose work has appeared in Esquire and The Times and The Atlantic and The Washington Post, among many others. And I am curious to know, Shannon, as much as, you know, your piece is not about passing a value judgment on any of these individual videos that had everyone obsessing earlier this year, especially with the Pentagon and the U.S. government saying, okay, we acknowledge we've been studying them. We can't explain all of these UAP, unidentified aerial phenomena. Do you make any sort of value judgment on that? I mean, have you spent any time sort of geeking out on that stuff, or do you think this is a waste of time?
I definitely talked to my friends about it. My friend and colleague Sarah Scholes wrote an absolutely fantastic book about UFOs, and anybody who's listening should read it. She's done her due diligence and is a fantastic writer. I think that it is a fascinating subject. I personally do not believe that any of the UAPs that we have footage of or stories of are aliens. There are probably other governments who are experimenting with specific aircraft. We do the same thing, so it doesn't seem that far-fetched. But I don't judge people's fascination with it or obsession with it even. I think that the concept of UFOs and aliens contains so much hope and excitement for us that it's hard to, you know, want to judge people who are really into that or believe that, you know, they've been visited or that aliens have been here. It's sort of, I think it's just a really hopeful thing, because we don't want to be alone. We don't want to feel alone. And just in general, in our own personal lives, let alone cosmically, right? To think, what if it is just us? It's entirely possible it's just us, but it's really not likely that it is just us, which is a really hopeful feeling, I think.
Yeah, it's a commentary on the human condition. Combating loneliness can happen in many, many different ways. And again, that's not just to dismiss the claims or dismiss the videos. But certainly that's part of maybe some of the desire to see this through, or desire, the hope that it's what people are envisioning it to be. Here's a comment from a listener on Twitter who says, Evan, I love the show, and question for you. Are we sure math is a universal language? Our math is a system developed by a species that exists in and can only visualize a three-dimensional space with an immutable fourth dimension, i.e. we can't intuitively understand quantum mechanics, end quote. What do you think, Shannon?
Exactly. That is a great question. And I think that while that is true, we are, you know, I think that the fact that we don't understand what dark energy is and what dark matter is, and that there's a huge conflict between the quantum realm and general relativity, is a testament to the fact that there's math and physics we have yet to discover. Like, we're a very young species, so we've done pretty well so far, I think, in terms of our ability to understand math and physics. But the basic fundamentals of physically departing a planet, gravity, special relativity, the way that space-time works, those are the very fabric of the universe, is a universal thing, and the core of that is math. So any being that has constructed a spacecraft, that has figured out their own launch capability, the trajectory and escape velocity that they need to leave their planet, that's math. So there is a root at the basis of all of that, which is, again, why Carl Sagan puts that in the movie Contact, which is, do they understand what 1 + 1 is? They know that it equals 2. You know, there is their communication saying, we know what math is, which means we know everything. So bring it on. So that is a great question, and we are incredibly limited, but any being that is in the cosmos that has been able to travel or evolve, at least to the point where we are, can communicate with us via math.
Sure, and I brought up the law of thermodynamics as well, because anyone who's using energy would eventually understand that there are some forms of energy that have different impacts on whatever the environment is in which the energy is being consumed. Mm-hmm. And so...
Exactly. That is a huge part of it, too, the electromagnetic spectrum. I mean, that is universal. That is what light is. That is what sound is. That's what radio waves are. If they built telescopes or could even understand the function of their star, they would know, okay, this is... They're just basic core elements to our understanding of how the cosmos works. So that is one shared hope that we could have with another being, excuse me, is that they would understand that. So we could at least say, hey, do you get that, you know, how fusion works? And they would say, yeah, I understand how fusion works. Even if that was just passing a math equation back and forth, that would be a huge step.
Yeah, right. So to the listener who wrote in kind of challenging this idea, it is entirely possible, if not likely, that if aliens get to us before they get to them, they are way better at math than we are. They understand it in much more complex ways than we do, but some of those basic principles are still there and could still be communicated. Mm-hmm. Adrian writes to say, Evan, we should not conflate technological advancement with moral advancement. You can imagine the Carib tribe seeing Columbus's ships arrive and think, well, if they figured out how to sail around the world, surely they'll stop having wars. And Adrian goes on to say, expansion has served as a safety valve for many past warlike societies. Expansion might be the way they get past the great filter. Thank you, Adrian. I think, Shannon, let me kind of build on Adrian's point and maybe see what you think here. I totally agree with you that we are not necessarily, or we're not very unlikely that we're going to be food, because anybody who's got to come this far has figured out a way to eat. They're not just coming here to eat. Probably they don't need the resources, because anybody who could come this far has figured out how to do that efficiently and don't just need to come here for iron ore. But they might make the assumption that even a primitively technological civilization, which they might view us to be, is still worth putting down in its infancy before it can develop more, in case that it becomes warlike. It might be in their interest to control the neighborhood. And maybe that's where Adrian is going. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that is a really great point and a great question. And I would, that's sort of the underlying thesis of that essay, which is that perspective, that inherent fear, is incredibly human. And also, I would add, incredibly American, that we are automatically figure they would start a war. They would want to wipe out the neighborhood and make sure that they were safe. That is an incredibly colonialist perspective, which is inherently built into our society, right? It's something that I'm trying to draw awareness to in a lot of those pieces I write, which is we are projecting our own fears, our own habits onto a being that we have no idea what they would be like, what would be important to them. Any entity that has gotten that far, I mean, sure, they could be like the Vogons in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and they just go around the universe blowing stuff up. not likely, but it's possible. So, you know, a lot of science fiction and our own past historical behavior informs a lot of those perspectives. And I think that, you know, on the one hand, you can weigh, well, should we worry about sending out signals in case, you know, another intelligent civilization finds us and says, oh, well, they're going to be a threat. All they'd have to do is watch us through a telescope or swing by the planet and kind of observe us and go, these people have no idea what they're doing. They're almost blowing themselves up on a regular basis. They're still burning dinosaur bones. They're not a threat. Truly. Any intelligent civilization would look at us and go, yeah, let's go check out the next planet. So, I mean, and that's maybe a little slightly pessimistic view of our own culture at the moment, but it's that, again, that's just to think about whenever we are asking questions about aliens, to take it back and point it back at yourself and say, how much am I projecting my own incredibly human feelings onto an unknown being?
Are we assuming they're all capitalists in space? You never know.
Yes, exactly. Probably not.
let me grab Mark. This is a former New York State Assemblyman, Mark Johns from Fairport. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi there, folks. I just had a quick question for you. When highly advanced civilizations come in contact with lesser advanced civilizations or cultures, usually the smaller culture ends up losing its customs, its languages, its beliefs. They sometimes get wholly absorbed into the larger civilization. And so something in the smaller culture is lost. Do you see anything like that happening if some highly advanced alien were to come in contact with us and essentially try to assimilate us into its culture or its civilization?
All right, Mark, thank you. Different Mark than I thought. Go ahead, Shannon. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that is, there's two sort of outlooks to that or answers to that. On the one hand, that's sort of what happens also, again, sorry, Evan, for the spoiler, sort of what happens in Arrival, right? we learn the language, and then we start teaching the heptapod language to everybody, right? So they can have the gift of understanding that language. On the other hand, you know, it is true, as we've seen from history in our own history, what happens when we go and invade other lands and smaller cultures, you know, they sort of vanish. And that is a huge danger. And I think that the fact that we fear that for ourselves is a really great opportunity to look out and see how we do that in the opposite direction. But I don't see, again, like, I think I just have a lot of faith in this potential civilization that if they were to come here, that there would be a reason. And I don't think the reason would be to eat us. And I don't think the reason would be to blow us up, because they could just do that easily. We wouldn't even see it coming. But it would be to communicate, for the same reason why, you know, we put whales and dolphins in tanks and desperately try to study them. And like, what are you saying? For the same reason. So I think that's pretty low on the list of possibilities that we would be, you know, become essentially whatever that alien civilization is like. On the other hand, what if it's really great? What if they bring us answers to, you know, how we utilize solar power and to stop wars and, you know, help us understand each other in every possible way? So in that way, if we became more like them, that would be a wonderful thing.
Shannon, I really wanted to move on to get to Space Billionaires, which we're going to do in a second, but we have a flood of feedback on what you've been talking about. So let me just try to cycle through that as fast as I can, and then we're going to talk Space Billionaires. Rich in Rochester, keep it tight. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, hi. How you doing, Evan?
Good, sir.
Number one, if there's a civilization so advanced to come here light years away, what we want, what we think, honestly, probably is not going to be that important. They will do what they want to do. But to that point, too, is why would they do it? And I think we do a horrible job of predicting how people will be. Even in our sci-fi, like Independence Day, a 20th century virus destroying another, a civilization thousands of years in advance. I mean, it's silly stuff that we do to try to put ourselves in a position of power. But in the end... Mm-hmm. What would we do? We have no, just like you said, if they want to blow us up, they can come light years. what we want and what we think probably is not that important.
Yeah, it's probably immaterial. I mean, Shannon, it's hard to argue that, isn't it?
No, exactly. I think he makes a great point. If they're that powerful and they would be so much more advanced and such an old civilization that there's nothing we would be able to do to stop them or, you know, anything. They would be the ones in control. But like he also made a great point is that we are terrible predictors of what's going to happen generally in our lives and also on a global scale. So it's fun to think about those things, but we're pretty bad at anticipating what would actually happen.
Yeah, not only predicting actions, but predicting motivations. That's right. Sam in Fairport, follow-up question about UAPs for your guest. Given the limited video and radar data evidence that we have, I've seen some conclude that these craft are exhibiting control of physics that are well beyond anything we can do, G-forces, acceleration, etc. What do you think?
I think that we give the U.S. military a lot of money and that they are developing technologies with aircraft, as they always have been, that we don't know about yet. And
most likely explanation.
A lot of smart physicists.
Yeah. Most likely explanation. Yeah.
There's the Occam's razor theory, which is the simplest explanation tends to be the right one. So is it likely that it's an alien that's going, you know, taking whoopty rides in our skies? Or is it the U.S. military that gets absurd amounts of funding developing new aircraft for wars?
Yeah.
So probably the latter.
And Michelle in Rochester wants to know what we make of Tabby Star, Tabitha Boyajian, and a star. So I was actually pretty obsessed with this back in 2015. I thought it was
Tabby Star is great.
I thought it was so cool because it was like the first possible evidence of a Dyson swarm, which is basically, we're going to get really geeky, listeners. The idea of a Dyson swarm is a technological civilization that is advanced enough to harvest the energy of its nearest star. And it can do that with a swarm of, you know, think of satellites like absorbing the energy, or it can do it in a sphere. And this star that is 1,500 light years away was observed to have a dimming. So something is orbiting it that really knocks out part of its light every once in a while. And the thought was, well, maybe it's like the shell of an old Dyson sphere. Maybe this was a technological, maybe it's currently technological. Probably what the best guess is now is it's probably a funky orbit of dust or cosmic material that's just abnormal but still natural, unless I'm missing something, Shannon.
No, that was the last I heard of it, too, is it's probably some leftover coagulated gunk from the circumstellar disk. But it would be so cool if that were a Dyson sphere, or just even an old one. That would be so awesome. But yeah, Tabby Star has a fascinating story, anybody that wants to look that up.
So cool, but unfortunately, it might be a boring outcome. Hey, it's not boring to study and gain better understanding. After we take this only break of the hour, I'm going to let guests listen to some of the thoughts of astrophysicist Brian Koberline, who has not only been a longtime Rochesterian, but someone who has communicated with some of the people who've been up in space with the space billionaires. We'll talk a little bit about his thoughts about our obsession with aliens lately and what he makes of the billionaire space race. He's got some mildly contrarian thoughts to share, and then we'll get Shannon's feedback on that. Shannon Sterone, a writer whose work appears in Esquire, The Times, Atlantic, Washington Post, and we will link you to her work, which you ought to be reading. It's fascinating stuff. It's coming up on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, we continue our series of interviews with the candidates for Rochester City Council. And then in our second hour, a lot of talk about changing Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day. We get some of the Italian perspective. This has been an important holiday for many people in the Italian-American community, and we'll talk about that on Monday on Connections.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important, best told, sometimes off the beaten path news stories from your favorite WXXI and city reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. And just this morning, I had a chance to talk to Brian Koberline, who is an astrophysicist and a science writer with the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, about some of these themes that Shannon is raising in her work. And I want to listen to some of what Brian had to say.
Thank you very much. Glad to be back.
We've got this idea that we're doing space all wrong here, that, you know, that it's become sort of a playground of the rich, the billionaires who want to go up and sort of compete with how high did you go and how high did you go and what counts as space. Yeah. And what counts as actually being in space. They claim that they want to create an opportunity for more people to gain a sense of wonder and to be in space and to bring that wonder back to Earth, et cetera. Are you on board with that? What do you make of all that?
I mean, I think that's part of the mission, obviously. You know, they want to be first, and if they can bring other people along, they can justify being first. There's also going to be a lot of money in space tourism. So there's that aspect as well.
Is there any sort of societal good to this, though?
I think there is some societal good. I mean, if you look through history and you see, say, the explorers of the Antarctic or the Arctic, or, you know, people who would push the envelope of where humans can go, a lot of that is driven by very wealthy people who were motivated and had the resources to do it. So this is not unusual that billionaires are kind of finding this new niche of discovery to do on their own. And that does make it more accessible to others. I mean, we are, I think Inspiration 4 cost $120 million, roughly, they're estimating. So that's only $40 million a person, which seems like a lot of money, and it is, but NASA costs something like $85 million per person. So we're already driving the price down.
But, you know, the lampooning headlines are something along the lines of boldly going where lots of people have gone before and not nearly as far as lots of people. You know, it's that kind of stuff. It's, you're going to spend all this money. You're barely going to make it into space if you're in space at all. And for what? So, I mean, I guess that's the rejoinder to all of this, but it sounds like you think it's a little bit more nuanced.
I think it's a little bit more nuanced. I think, you know, this is exactly the pattern that you see when new technology opens up. It's the wealthy who use it first, and the wealthy then drive down the price of it because more people are using it. You see that with computers, you see that with cell phones, you see that with all the technology we have. You know, it's expensive at first. And so, of course, the wealthy are going to get first access.
I take the point there. And before I ask you about a few other things, when we think about billionaires in space and space tourism, there may be some local ties and even a connection that you are familiar with. What's the story there?
So one of the SpaceX missions, Inspiration 4, that was a billionaire, someone whose ticket was paid by a billionaire, someone covered by a charity, and one other person, Sion Proctor, who graduated from Fairport High School. She was one of 70,000 people who applied to be able to get on this flight, and she won it. And my connection to her is that she was part of a education outreach group to Chile that I was part of. So we actually know each other relatively well, but she has said it's amazing. I mean, who wouldn't want to go on, you know, an orbit around the Earth? And she has tried for years to get there. That was been her life mission. You know, she applied to the astronaut program. She got shortlisted, almost made the cut, and then didn't quite make the cut to become an astronaut. And then this came up and she got it. So she had a lifelong dream that was fulfilled because some billionaire wanted to go into space. It's not a bad deal for her.
Let's now turn our focus in the direction of what you think maybe we can also do besides space tourism to spark our interest in maybe in a direction that is, brings more people into a sense of wonder and makes people appreciate and want to pursue knowledge about it, but also continues to serve humanity in different ways. You know, and you're an educator. You've been writing about this. You're one of the best I've met on this. What else besides space tourism can spark our interest in ways that are productive?
I think a lot of it is that you're going to start seeing, as more people go into space, you're going to see that feedback. You know, that it used to be that the rare astronaut who got to see Earth from space came back and had this transformative experience. But how many stories can they tell? And if you imagine 1,000 people being able to do that and see the Earth from space and see it as one planet, that will have a cultural shift over time, the same way that common airline travel changed the way we experience the world. So there are some transformative things coming on. But I think in a larger part, it's also we should be engaged, because if we don't as a society write what the rules of space are, the billionaires will. I think that's the real risk that we have to worry about, is that they're going out into space, and if they decide the rules, they will write them.
Elaborate on that a little bit. What's the worst case scenario with the rule writing there?
Well, if billionaires have access to space, they have access to surveillance in space. They have access to things like asteroid mining. They have access to who can go into space and who can't. Imagine something, you've talked before, I think yesterday, about Facebook and how it controls access of people to the internet because it's so dominant. It's not that you can't put up your own website. It's just that if you do, you're not going to be heard. You have to go through the billionaire social media companies in order to be heard. So imagine doing that with space travel. The only way you go into space is through their paths, in their ways, to their destinations.
And before I let you go, on the subject of who is in space already, there's been a lot of discussion this year about UFOs, about what the government knew, Brian, and what they held from us, and the release of strange, grainy videos. But anyway, I'm curious to know where you stand on the obsession that we've had with aliens in this way.
Aliens are cool. We love aliens. You know, we have them in movies. We have them in stories. It's a fascinating idea to think about, that we might make contact with a completely different alien race. That's cool to think about. But I think we also need a rational head in terms of what actually the evidence says. And there just isn't a lot of evidence to say that aliens are here.
Does our obsession with these videos, these documents, is it healthy? Is it unhealthy?
I think you can take it too far. I mean, certainly you can say, oh, that's cool. That's interesting. Maybe. I don't know. But if you start making this a global conspiracy, I think you've crossed the line. It's not very useful to think of it in that way.
That is astrophysicist Brian Koberline. And a lot there, Shannon Sterone, who's a science writer, who's joining us and who's been very critical of billionaires in space. But so Brian's, I think, doing two things. He's, to the extent that you can defend billionaires in space, I mean, Rich Lowry of the National Review has, and Reason has, they've made similar arguments that Brian made, which is that anytime something monumental sort of has to happen that's difficult, that costs a lot of money, you do need people with deep pockets. They go out and they do it, and then they make it more accessible over time. The first computers cost a lot of money. The first treatments and drugs cost a lot of money, and then they become less expensive. And so maybe billionaires in space means this whole process is going to be more accessible eventually, and it will spark new ideas and new interest in the cosmos among all of us, or maybe not. I don't know. But he also is concerned about what it means that we're gatekeeping with billionaires in charge here. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on some of those themes, Shannon.
Yeah, I love what he said. And I agree with some and disagree with a lot of it. But it's just not surprising. I agree that there is, of course, a possibility and even maybe a likelihood that the more affordable these launches become, or these, you know, tourist tickets to, you know, the Von Karman line or 50 kilometers, depending on which company you're going with, could change the perspective of the most wealthy people who are first able to take those trips, right? So, and that's a great thing, because if you have people who are billionaires or even hundreds of millionaires going to space who have the ability to sway elections or sway who is voted into office, who can then say, hey, you know, I went to space. Earth is really amazing. We need to do something about climate change. That's the best case scenario, I think, for that level of space tourism. I think that by the time those flights become affordable, the way that I can buy a flight on American Airlines and it's not going to cost me, you know, 10 or 50 years worth of income, it's going to cost me a few hundred bucks. By the time we had average citizens going to that space and, you know, could see Earth in that way, you know, if we want them to come back and say, God, you know, I really want to take better care of this planet, we're way past the 7-year line of where we need to take significant climate action, right? So we're in and too urgent of a space in that area for appreciation of the planet that we shouldn't have to send people to space to have them care about Earth. We're so far past that point. I would also argue that while it is always wonderful, and I would of course love to have that experience myself, to go to space and see our atmosphere and be in that darkness to feel weightless for, you know, just a few minutes, that is not going to change the world in the way that cell phones or computers did. You know, it will make things nice and will be a wonderful memory for people and will probably forever change some people. But in terms of, yeah, the technology and medicines always go to the wealthy first, this is not the same thing. And Brian expressed some concern about, you know, we have to make sure that billionaires aren't setting the rules, that they're not the ones who are, you know, gatekeeping. Like, we're already past that point. They have set the rules. I mean, SpaceX has essentially made sure that the FCC votes in a way that favors mega constellations, and that benefits Jeff Bezos as well because he has his own mega constellation he's about to launch. We're way past the point of worrying about billionaires dictating the rules of space. They already are. That's the problem, is that to say that we can better humanity by having space tourism with these companies, and then in the other breath say, well, we should also make sure that, you know, they're not dictating the rules of things. Like, you can't have both. If you're giving money to those companies and to those leaders, you're, you know, sort of countering the other concern.
Melanie emails the program to say, would you really call what they are doing exploration? Maybe I'm misunderstanding. Will they ever be able to go somewhere worth exploring, these billionaires in space? It's definitely not exploration now. It's barely just leaving the atmosphere. That's true. And in fact, Shannon detailed, there's even a debate about what constitutes getting to space. Like, how high up do you have to go? I mean, that's how...
Yeah.
Silly some of this is. But Melanie's just asking.
It is silly. I mean, we're also already in space. That's sort of a thing I think we really have a trouble understanding, is that, you know, that's why I have the Earthrise picture as the background on my Twitter profile, because we are literally in space. We're just nestled in a really nice, safe atmosphere, but we're in space. We're very much in space. We're just in an atmosphere in space. So I like my friend Robin George Andrews wrote a spectacular article about this too, which is sort of pointing out the silliness of that debate. But yeah, it's kind of a moot point.
Another listener says, sounds like you would make the same arguments against the Wright brothers. I don't know, Shannon. That actually doesn't strike me as a good parallel, because they were inventing something new. Space billionaires are boldly going where many people have already been.
Exactly, and I love when you say that, because it's true and it's hilarious that the Wright brothers.
I didn't coin that.
We
I'm
didn't
stealing
have airplanes.
That. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but steal away. I mean, the Wright brothers invented something. I mean, we didn't have airplanes, and now we have airplanes. You know, these guys who are saying, we're going to space and we're doing this thing for the first time, having commercial companies take civilians who, you know, on a rocket and launching them up and doing that, that is a first. That is absolutely a first. But, you know, we've gone to Pluto. We've sent a spacecraft that is in between our star and another star.
Yeah.
We are well past we went 50 kilometers up. I mean, pilots go that high up every day practicing like in Top Gun. I mean, there is nothing revolutionary here. It is not exploration. And people get mad when I say that, but it is not at all.
Preston writes and says, Evan, I am so less worried about the prospect of aliens eating us or doing anything harmful than I am of our fellow citizens who storm nation capitals, threaten public health workers, threaten and terrorize teachers and fellow neighbors at school board meetings. Bring on the aliens. That's from Preston.
I agree.
That's pretty dark. When Preston concludes the aliens can't be worse, that's pretty dark, man.
Yeah, that's pretty dark. I mean, I think this kind of ties back to the essay, honestly. And while I didn't get to go too far into it, I think that collectively, all of humanity, where we are in a deep state of angst and despair, and it understandably so. I mean, climate change, storming of the Capitol, a pandemic. I mean, these are hard times. It's a hard time to be a human right now. So feeling skeptical and pessimistic about our ability to pull ourselves out of this and do better is understandable. I feel that way too. But I think that's part of the fun of having these discussions about aliens, and you tying billionaires in there as well, which is that when we write movies or write books about intelligent civilizations that are good, right? When we think truly, truly good, the best of what we could imagine ourselves to be, they help one another. They're kind, they're compassionate, they're intelligent. They're not greedy. They share what they know. And that is when we write those characters, it's because we want to be that way, right? We want humans to be that way. So if we want to get there, we have to do that. Like, we have to actually act that way and embody the feeling of what we want those aliens to be, our saviors. Like, they're not our saviors. We have to save ourselves in this instance, which is much harder and a lot less fun.
All right, 75 seconds left. So Ed and Sotis, you got to keep it tight. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, hi. Going back to the original point of have they been here, look, when they retired the SR-71, with huge fanfare, there was not one word about its replacement. Now, its replacement is going to blow us out. It's going to blow our minds. And this is why my feeling is that they have admitted that they're aware that they're around. My feeling is that the crash in Roswell, they had that vehicle and they reverse engineered it, which gives them what they have now.
Okay, I got you. So the reason our technology is so good is because aliens have been here and we've learned from their technology.
Absolutely. And there's so much more to learn. This is the tip of the iceberg.
All right, I appreciate that. I mean, I don't share that belief, but I understand the reasoning behind it. The hang-up I have, Shannon, is they got all the way here and then they crashed. But, you know, I mean, like, but maybe I'm.
Yeah, that was what a terrible denouement to their story. Right? Just,
yeah.
Oh, we went to travel to another star system and then we crashed in the desert.
But hey,
it's not likely.
It's not likely, but it's not impossible. And I want to just leave the door open and respect Ed's point of view there, because the technology that is coming out now is pretty remarkable. So, Ed, whether we reverse engineered something else or not, it's remarkable technology. And who knows? But Shannon Sterone, a writer whose work has been in Esquire, we'll post the piece so you can check it out. You ought to read that. And Shannon, I always have fun with you. I hope you come back. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
One of the best science writers on the scene today. What a great way to end the week on this program. Fun stuff today. Thanks to Randy Gorbman engineering the broadcast today. Megan Mack producing, Emma Ray Stein, Evan Dawson. The whole team saying thanks for listening. We're back with you Monday on member-supported public radio.